Go ahead and put that picture up here. This is one of my favorite pictures. This is a year ago, October. That's Paul. If you don't know Paul, he went to heaven last spring. This is his small group, and they were imitating him. And I put it up not just because it's one of my favorite pictures, but because it's an Advent picture. And like the song was talking about, the already not yet. Christ has come, peace has come, but peace will be consummated when he returns again. And this picture of our friend is a picture of a man with a future who extends past his physical death last spring. And that's because of the advent of Christ, the coming of Christ. And so the reason why it's Advent is you look at the picture, I look at the picture, and there's sorrow, and yet sorrow doesn't have the last word. There's hope. And it's not hope wishful thinking, it's hope based on the promises of Christ, very reliable source. So a couple of things here. First, this is a picture of Advent because Paul lives even though he has died. And then second, when those of us who know Paul knew that he was a crooked stick that God used to draw a straight line with somehow. And that's true of all of us that God uses. Paul was a man who knew his need. He felt pain, loneliness. He felt his own failure. He felt these things deeply. He knew he was incapable of saving himself, yet he has been saved. And I would venture to guess that some of us, some of the time, maybe have a feeling that we don't really need saving, and that feeling would be wrong. But I think that all of us, some of the time, and some of us most of the time, feel utterly unworthy, unuseful, unusable. And we wonder, how could we truly be valuable to God? And one of the most destructive and common of the thinking distortions is what's called emotional reasoning. I feel it, therefore it must be true. And while it may be true that I feel it, it's not necessarily true just because I feel it. But when feelings are powerful enough inside of a human mind and heart, we have trouble not believing them. So let's talk about worth or value. When you feel unworthy, when you feel not valuable, how often would you say that feeling becomes your own reality? And if you're honest, I think you would say that very often it colors the world around you. It begins to become reality for you. And it's of vital importance that we learn to feel what we feel without letting feelings become tyrants that dictate what we must believe and how we must behave. And we feel what we feel, and this is how God has made us. He's made us to feel deeply. But we put our faith in the facts because this is how God has called us to live. But when I say facts, don't hear me say cold, unfeeling facts, but facts that are full of passion. Because facts and feelings are not enemies. In the best cases, they collaborate. And if you feel that you are a thinker, then you love facts. And if you think of yourself as a feeler, then to you, facts can be cold tools, useful but not beautiful. But every single feeler thinks and every single thinker feels. And all of us struggle with knowing what it means to be thinking, feeling, choosing children of God. So let's look at some facts about the passion of the Christ. And the passion of Christ comes from a Greek word that means suffering. And these dynamic facts speak directly to our deepest needs, our deepest longing, our deepest feelings, and then they transform our behavior if we let them. And we're speeding to a conclusion in our year in Mark. And it's a fascinating book, the first gospel written. And for 8 chapters, Mark is sort of taking us on a leisurely stroll with Jesus through the villages in the back country. Jesus is in no hurry. He's speaking to this person, that, healing someone, calling some people, teaching, praying, sleeping, walking, eating. Then at the halfway point, Mark 8:31, everything changes. And he begins to teach at that point that he's going to suffer and die and rise again. And then his pace quickens and the book's pace quickens. And now the Lord is moving resolutely towards the cross. And then the last third of the book is the last week of the life of Jesus. And so we're going to spend today and then next Sunday in chapter 15. And then we'll finish the year in the last chapter of the book. So this morning we're in 15 verses 33 to 37. At the 6th hour, darkness came over the whole land until the 9th hour. At the 9th hour, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," which means, "My God, Why have you forsaken me? And when some of those standing near heard this, they said, listen, he's calling Elijah. One man ran, filled a sponge with wine vinegar, put it on a stick, and offered it to Jesus to drink. Now leave him alone. Let's see if Elijah comes to take him down, he said. With a loud cry, Jesus breathed his last. The curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And when the centurion who stood there in front of Jesus heard this cry, his cry, and saw how he died, he said, surely this man was the Son of God. And N.T. Wright said that we need regularly to find ways of making this story strange again so we can hear it once more as though it were new to us. And he's right, because this is a very strange story. It's absolutely true, but it's absolutely strange. There's never been a story like it. And there are myths out there in human cultures that resemble these facts, like myths of dying and rising gods. But that's to be expected, because human myths are echoes of real things. But there's nothing of myth in this narrative. But there's a lot strange here, like 3 hours of midday darkness, a cry of despair from the Son of God, a curtain torn from top to bottom, and then a brutal non-believer making a confession of faith. So I want to look at these strange goings-on and how they impact our lives today. First, the 3 hours of midday darkness. On my phone, I have a weather app, and I have Wichita because I live there. I have Denver because my daughter lives there. I have Norfolk because I go there sometimes. And I have Nome because I love to see how long the days are in the summer and how short they are in the winter. And on Thursday, the sunrise was 11:47 in Nome. And I actually went to Nome when I was a kid. And sunset was 4:01, 4 hours and 14 minutes of daylight. And that's depressing to think about. And in the gospel, we can see that the critical events of Jesus' death happened in the dark. The betrayal happened in the dark. The mock trial before the Jewish courts happened in the dark. And now, at the actual time of his death, even though it's daytime, there's deep darkness. And the sun is going to come up today at around noon in Nome, Alaska. But in Jerusalem, when the sun died, the world went dark at noon. The sixth hour was noon, and the ninth hour was 3 p.m., and so as the Lord was dying during that time, there was total darkness. And this was no solar eclipse. Some people have said this is the Passover time. And at the Passover, it's a full moon. There are no solar eclipses at that time. Maybe it was a desert windstorm. I've been there in desert windstorms. They create brown worlds, but nothing like this kind of darkness. It was a supernatural darkness. And in the Exodus, the midday darkness was God's judgment on Pharaoh and Egypt. So who was God judging here with midday darkness? Well, that's the second strange thing, this cry of despair from the Son of God. Jesus cried out, my God, why have you forsaken me? And he cried out in the Greek, a megas voice. It was a loud, violent cry. And so for the women who loved him, and unlike his male friends, had not deserted him, this cry had to pierce their hearts as they heard him give it from the cross. And then there were the gawkers and the soldiers, and it had to startle them, frighten them, confuse them, because they thought he was maybe calling out to Elijah. They were so startled by his cry. They misunderstood what he said. And this is only one of Jesus' seven sayings from the cross that Mark records. And so why did he choose to use this saying in his evangelistic book to the Romans that he was writing to? Well, the Romans worshiped gods of power. The Roman emperor was a god, they thought, more than human. And here is the Christian Messiah crying out in pain. He was not dying like a good soldier should. He wasn't dying with stoic silence. And these words demonstrate the horror of sin that Jesus felt as he experienced separation from the Father. And just the night before, he'd asked if he could be spared the cup of God's wrath, and he was told no. There's no other way. So why was he shrieking out why the very next day? Well, it wasn't because he suddenly had intellectual doubts regarding theodicy. Is God there? Is God good? Is God powerful? He didn't have intellectual doubts about those things. It wasn't a cry of confusion. He wasn't suddenly wondering if there was purpose in his suffering. He knew his purpose and he was resolute in it. He wasn't feeling sorry for himself. It wasn't a classic case of why me. So what was it? Of course, I don't know. And whatever I would say would be less true than the real truth. But at the very least, he's doing what humans do when they suffer. And in his humanity, he was crying out to God. And when humans love God, they cry out to God when they suffer. And he was crying out to God in his pain. It's what people do who have learned to trust God. In this case, he's crying out to God in his pain, even as God is turning from him. And I watched a documentary last week on some Jews who had survived the Nazi death camps or had lost loved ones and they spent the rest of their lives seeking revenge from these Nazis. And one group, right after the war was over, they successfully poisoned the food supply of a POW camp that held Nazi SS. And they killed a couple thousand of these guys by poisoning their bread. It wasn't an act of war, it was pure act of vengeance. The war was over. And then in some of the cells of the death camps, they had found written in blood the word vengeance. And the group of Jews that spent their lives getting vengeance had a Hebrew name that translated into avengers. So step aside, Captain America. These people lived and breathed to avenge. And many of them died unsatisfied. And I heard their testimonies. They were clearly unfulfilled in the way they were expressing their anger. And so when humans suffer, emotions rage. For some, that emotion turns into revenge and hate. But when the Son of God suffered, his emotions raged. It's what happens to people when they suffer. But he didn't curse the soldiers. He didn't curse the Jewish leaders. He didn't curse his cowardly friends. He cried out in anguish to God. And was he looking for an answer in his why? I don't think so. He wasn't confused about the why. The why was the normal cry of a human heart as it suffers. And for him, he was experiencing the weight of sin, our sin. Why have you forsaken me? He knows why. These are words that welled up in his soul and poured from his mouth. Psalms is the largest book in the Bible, right smack in the middle of the Bible. And it's the one that Jesus quoted the most by far. He probably had it memorized. And what he's saying here is directly from Psalms 22. My God, why have you forsaken me? And it's interesting that Psalms, the largest book in the Bible, is full of why. Full of heartfelt, passionate why. So God inspired the writing of the book of Psalms. God inspired the inclusion of it in our Bible right in the middle. And so think about this. God determined that a book that centers on human emotions and is full of prayers questioning him be positioned at the center of the book and be the longest book. At the very least, it tells us God's not very insecure, is he? He's okay with the longest book in the middle being full of why. It also tells us that often, at least for me, our ideas of faith and maturity are out of sync with the Bible. I had hoped for a kind of faith when I was a younger man that would allow me to become dispassionate in the face of trouble. That's what I wanted. I want to be able to not be touched by trouble. I didn't want to escape trouble. I knew it was going to come, but I wanted to be able to rise above it. So I thought that resilience was a kind of toughness where your heart gets calluses on it and trouble can't penetrate it. It can come to your life, but it can't penetrate your heart. And as I got older, I realized that was more Buddha than Jesus. For the Buddha, life is suffering. Suffering is caused by desire. You eliminate suffering by eliminating desire. Do you see any of that here on the cross? The Lord's expressing his suffering with great passionate emotions. When human beings invent religions, we would have had Jesus, first of all, he would have just destroyed the soldiers and come down. But if he did stay up there on the cross, he would have been dispassionate. He would have been stoic, emotionless. But that's not what happened in reality. And he's suffering because of his passion. He's suffering because of his great passion for God. And fellowship with God was being broken at that point by our sins. And so it's important to note that while he showed us full bore passion and emotion, he showed us it's okay to despair, it's okay to feel deeply, and it's okay to express all those feelings to God. He also showed us that he didn't use emotional reasoning to live his life. And his emotions were normal. They're based on the reality of his situation. But here's what's interesting. Those emotions didn't lead him to choose to get off the cross. It seems to me that what he was feeling and what he was choosing were at odds on the cross. He felt deep anguish, deep despair, deep pain. And unlike the other two guys dying beside him, he didn't have to stay there. He had a choice. They didn't have a choice. He did have a choice. No one made him die. They didn't take his life. He went to Jerusalem on his own accord. He let them take him. Matthew says that in Gethsemane, when the soldiers came and his boys pulled their swords and Peter hacked off a guy's ear, Jesus said, "Put your swords back. You guys do know I could call thousands of angels to come right now if I wanted them." He could have warriors with frightening power right there, right then. Here on the cross, the same choice was his. And so what we see is passionate, searing emotion, at the same time, a choice to stay in the will of God. And so it's important to understand that we can be passionate people who feel deeply and express ourselves honestly to God and others. At the same time, we don't have to use emotional reasoning to actually live our lives. The third interesting thing, strange thing, is the tearing of the cross. Jesus cries out again. John says, tells us what the words were. His final cry were, "It's finished," then he died. And at that moment, while the land was dark, the temple, which was just a few kilometers away, the curtain that hung, that separated the people from the presence of God, was torn top to bottom. Now, if this was a myth, if this didn't really happen, it would have been easy to disprove, because thousands would have been in the temple in the days following the death of Jesus, and they would have seen the curtain is still there. I'm looking at it. But when the Gospels were written just a few decades after this, there would have been many, many, many people alive who could have said, "That didn't happen. I was in the temple the next day." And the movement would have lost steam. It would have lost credibility. But what happened to the movement? It gained steam and it gained credibility because this happened. The curtain in the temple, which was really more like a wall than a curtain, it was so thick, so heavy, it was like a wall, and it kept people from the inner chamber where God's presence was evident. Only priests could go there on behalf of the people. And this tearing of the curtain top to bottom, meaning God did it, also means the temple is finished. And in about 35 years, it's going to be totally dismantled, but its purpose has been taken over by the event that just happened. So from now on, access into the presence of God is open to everyone through the death of his son. And then the fourth strange thing is this brutal, unbelieving Roman making a confession of faith. And when you look at this, at first glance, this fourth strange thing doesn't seem to be in the same category as the first three. Supernatural darkness, that's strange. The Son of God in despair is strange. A miraculous remodeling of the temple is strange. But a man saying some things doesn't seem all that strange. But let's look at it. I've seen just three people take their last breath, and I'll never forget any of those. But in our culture, unless you're in healthcare, or maybe you've been in combat, you've probably not seen many people die, been present when they die. But here in Mark, he's writing to a Roman audience, and he says that a Roman centurion is the one who made the first post-passion confession of faith. And centurions were enlisted men who rose up through the ranks, and so they were battle-proven and battle-hardened. And this guy was, without question, knowing the historical context, he was a hardened, brutal man, and he had seen people die, and he had probably killed people. He'd probably seen people die at his own hand. So let's look again at what happened. The centurion, when he stood there in front of Jesus, heard his cry, saw how he died. He said, "Surely this man was the Son of God." And you might recognize this statement. Go back almost a year ago, Mark 1:1, the beginning of the gospel about Jesus Christ, the Son of God. That's how the book started. Mark 1:11, he came up out of the water, and he heard from heaven, "You're my son." On the Mount of Transfiguration, "This is my son whom I have loved." In Mark 16, the high priest asked, "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One?" Jesus said, "I am." And so now, as the passion of Jesus is complete, the soldier who was used to death was being touched by this particular death. And he said, "Surely this is the Son of God." So we don't know all that was going on in this guy's mind or how Mark knew this. I wonder if he became part of the church and told this story in church over and over. At any rate, he's a soldier who had sworn allegiance to Caesar, and the only one he would call the Son of God would have been Caesar, and now he's calling a dead Jewish teacher the Son of God. And this is a guy who would have been scarred from visible and invisible wounds, body and mind, taught to stuff his emotion, be tough, and he was touched by the cries of Jesus, by how he died. And if you read the rest of the Gospels, you know that the Lord is being tender with these criminals on both sides of him. He's being tender with his mom. He's praying for forgiveness for those who are killing him. And somehow, as this soldier watched all this, it impacted him, it changed him. John records that the final words of Jesus as he died were, "It is finished." Not, "I'm finished," but "it's finished." And "it" means he completed our salvation. And like Rodney said, "it" means we have a completed objective standard by which to measure both our current status with God, how am I doing with God, and our eternal destiny, what's going to happen to me when I die. And all man-made religions, all of them, leave you wondering about your current status with God and your final destiny. And so you have to somehow prove yourself, work to prove yourself worthy to God. You never quite know if you're good enough until the end. Last week, a Navy admiral, a two-star, was fired for a night of conduct unbecoming an officer. And this happened in the spring. He was just fired last week. And he asked at his hearing, "Judge me on my 34-year career, not a single night." And the response, to paraphrase, was, "Thanks for your service, you're fired." And that's how humans tend to think. And by the way, that's not a bad thing if you're a two-star. A single night is enough to undo a 34-year career. But we tend to think of God that way, that I must somehow through my life's work complete my own salvation, and I can at any point in time blow the whole thing, all the way up to the point I die. And if we think this way, we come up with scorecards. We measure our lives against a standard. We have to, because we have to know, am I okay, how am I doing? And the standard becomes either a person or the Bible, usually. So we turn the Bible into a list of things either to be proud of, because I'm checking them off, or be ashamed of, because I'm not. And so pride or shame becomes a course that we live our lives, both terrible ways to live our lives. Or we measure against others, same thing. I'm either doing better than this person or I'm doing worse than this person. Either way, I'm either proud or ashamed. But if we understand what happened on the cross, if we're understanding increasingly what "it is finished" means, then more and more we can feel unworthy. We can get up and feel one day like a failure. We can feel worthless to God, not valuable to God. But in fact, if I've trusted Christ, those feelings do not have to dictate my life direction, how I respond to other people, how I move through life. The Bible is not something I use to feel proud or feel shame about all the ways I'm succeeding or failing. It becomes a path of life. It's how I maximize my joy in God and the glory of God. Others are not tools to measure my own worth by. Am I doing better than Craig or worse than Craig? Am I ahead of her or behind her? Others are opportunities to love and be loved. It's transformational for us. And so the gospel has profound implications for our lives at a very personal level. Our feelings are powerful and important, and we can and we should take them to God. But we don't have to let them dictate the course of our life, because the passion of the Christ is the fact that tells you who you are and what you mean to God. If you feel worthless, take that feeling to God. But we have to live by the facts. If we feel abandoned by God, if we feel like we're not doing enough, if we feel like we don't measure up. We all struggle with this. I mean, my mom was an amazing lady who impacted many lives, but until the end of her life, she felt like that she was not quite doing enough. But then she lived by the facts of her faith. You feel like God can't be good, He can't be powerful, He can't be present in your suffering, then believe what's true about God and you. And this belief, this faith, is based on what Jesus did on the cross. And we all choose our life direction by choosing what we focus our attention and our affection on. And so here's two things you could think about as you feel your way through life. The two cries of Christ on the cross, they can shape the way you live your life. Why God? And it tells us something about our relationship with God. It tells us something about our ability to go to Him honestly without faking or hiding. I mean, there's just gut level honesty there. And then "it's finished" tells us something about how we can live our lives, not obeying our emotions, but believing the gospel. Keith Green recorded a song in 1977 that I think is probably it's undoubtedly the song that I've either listened to or sung in my head over and over and over more than any other song since probably 1978. And it always happens when I find myself beginning to strive to feel worthy. And this song begins to play in my head. In one line, the first line, my son, or you can substitute daughter, why are you striving? You can't add to what's been done for you. I did it all while I was dying. So the starting point for this life, this full life, is to just be still. Stop striving. And if you've been around at all the last year, you know that doesn't mean that we're not putting forth effort, but it means we stop striving to make ourselves worthy to God or valuable to God. You can take your feelings to God with complete honesty, but you live your life based on the reality of it's finished. And Roddy's going to come up and sing, but I want you to think about this, and I want you to feel this. You say, Terry, you don't know what I've done. You don't know what I've thought. You don't know what I struggle with. A good friend of mine said this week, I'm a disappointment to God. If you're a believer, you're not a disappointment to God. Because what it is finished says is that when God, because of what Christ did, when God, this is not just words, but when God looks at you, he sees his son, and his son did not disappoint him.